This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, or Reason.com, and rate and review us while you're there. My guest today is Mark J. Perry. He's an economist at the University of Michigan at Flint and the American Enterprise Institute in D.C. He also runs the great economics blog, Carpe Diem. And we're going to talk to him about recent census data showing record high levels of median household income in the United States and other similar positive results. But we're also going to find out, or we're going to ask some questions about why, if we're getting richer, why don't we really feel any better about that kind of stuff? There's an interesting paradox going on. Mark, thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Nick.
Let's walk through some of your findings first. What is the current or the most recent, this is for 2017, what's the median household income? And what's it saying about things?
Yeah, these data come out once a year. And so annually, when the data come out, I do an analysis and report. So came out in September. And so I wrote up an analysis of what I thought were some kind of the key findings. And so kind of the main headline data that came out of this was that the median household income last year for Americans was $61,372. That was the highest it's ever been. It was an increase of 1.8% from the year before. And maybe kind of also important is the fact that it was the fifth consecutive annual increase in real median household income that started in 2013.
And this is a median household income means that half of households that report, you know, tax data or whatever that are in the census, half are making more than that and half are making less of that.
That's right. And these dollar figures are adjusted for inflation. So it's an inflation adjusted, you know, or real dollars to make an accurate comparison from previous years. So, you know, we had five consecutive declines from 08 to 2012 because of the effects of the Great Recession. And so now we've really started on an upward path in terms of household income, and it was at an all-time high record level. And so I think that's kind of part of the good news that came out of this.
So, and then also, explain also the way that, you know, over time, especially if you adjust for the size of households, because households are considerably smaller than they were, say, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that it's not really a fair comparison over time because the households are changing. And so back in the 70s, for example, the average household had about three members, and now it's down to something like 2.55 or something, 2.54. So the average household size has declined over time just because of the demographic trends in the United States. So then what we really would want to do is adjust income based on household size. And so I did that and also showed either, you know, average income per household member or median income per household member. And so that also is showing an all-time high for the what we would call the median income per household member is also at an all-time high last year.
So what about, you know, one of the things that we hear all the time is that, you know, people are working harder for less money. That doesn't seem to be the case. We also hear that income inequality is going up. One of the things that you found as well is that when you look at the Gini coefficient, which is the primary measure that is used to kind of calculate inequality in a given economy, that's been flat for some time now. What is going on with that?
Yeah, you know, we hear all the time in the news, Obama said income inequality was the defining issue of our time. So there's a lot of headline reports and media kind of hand-wringing about this increase in income inequality and the rich getting richer, the poor getting poor. But when you look at the census's measure, the statistical measure of income inequality called the Gini index of income inequality, it's been relatively flat for about the last 24 or 25 years. And so you would think if the headline reports and media reports were true and that narrative was true that we have this huge increase in income inequality that needs some kind of public policy or higher taxes for the rich, you would think we would see that showing up in the Gini index, and yet we don't. So there's something going on here where the what we hear, the narrative in the media, is much different than what I find looking at the actual data. The other variable that the Census Bureau reports every year is looking at the income share that goes to the top 5% of U.S. households. And that's been relatively flat since the 1990s at about 21%. So you would also think that if more and more income is going to the top 5%, that that income share of that top income group should be going up, but it's not. I also show the income share for the top 20% of U.S. households. That's been roughly flat at about 50% since the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we don't see any real statistical evidence.
What about if you look at the dreaded top 1%, though? Are they peeling away at a quicker rate? Are they getting more?
I think that is true, and I'm not sure if the Census Bureau reports, since they do mostly mm-hmm. quintiles and top 20%, top 5% also, so I'm not quite sure if they do the top one. So maybe it would be true. Maybe that's where there might be some mm-hmm. evidence that, there's income inequality because a lot of the gains maybe are going to the top 1% or top of one half of 1%. So maybe that's where some of the concern is, although, right. again, you just don't see it like for the top 5%.
What about, one of the things that was striking in the piece that you wrote up at the Carpe Diem blog, which is housed at the AEI website, was the number of families, and this you adjust for inflation, you can track over time, but we've constantly heard, and I think you and I are probably around the same age, we've been growing up in a world where the middle class has always been vanishing. There's never been a time where, where fewer than about 50% of people will call themselves middle class, and they know that we are, a dying breed. What is going on with the number of the people who are in the middle third of the income distribution? Is that growing? Is it shrinking? How is the middle class doing?
Yeah, well, that's one analysis I do every year as well. And I kind of break out the households by different income levels. So, and I also have been really surprised by this because, again, it runs counter to the narrative we hear. But this is looking at what I called high income households that have income of $100,000 or more in 2017 dollars. And back in 1967, when the data series started, only 9% of U.S. households were in that high income category. And that share of households making $100,000 or more has gradually increased over time. And so now last year, 29.2% of U.S. households were in that top income group. So the share of U.S. households making $100,000 or more has more than tripled since the 1960s. And then I looked at a middle income category of income between $35,000 to $100,000, just because you have to, the definition of middle income or middle class is kind of subjective. So I picked that middle income group, and that the share of Americans living in that middle income category has also decreased over time. And then the low income category has also decreased over time in terms of the share of Americans in those middle income or low income. So I'm making the case that the middle class or middle income Americans households might be disappearing, but they're disappearing because they're moving up into higher income categories. And so
right.
I think that's really good news for the U.S. economy and our increasing standard of living.
Yeah. So, you're looking at, when you look at middle and high income people, there's significantly more people in that category instead of looking at, and I'm eyeballing it here from 1967, but it looks like, about 63% of people were in the middle or high income category in 1967, and that is now closer to 71%. And the most amazing thing is that the low income category has dropped from 37% to 30%. So those are, these are all good trends. Why do we, and before we move on to, why are the media narratives or why are the stories that we tell ourselves different than that? Talk a little bit about income mobility and how you measure income mobility. And here we're talking about how likely is it for a particular household or a particular individual to move up or down the level of, the income scale. What are you finding with that?
Yeah, and that's another very important point, is to not just look at, data at one point in time or some household's income, but to look at the mobility over time as individuals move from, we all kind of usually start in the bottom 20% and move up towards the top 20% of by income, and then when we're retired would move back down. Mm-hmm. So people don't, I think, appreciate enough the significant amount of income mobility over our lifetimes, and we kind of think that if we're in the bottom 20%, we're stuck there forever, or if you get in the top 20%, you're stuck there forever. But, you know, the Census Bureau doesn't do any analysis really on tracking the same individuals over time. But there was another report that came out recently, some research by a couple economists named Herschel and Rank, and what they showed, they looked at the same individuals or households over time, and what they found was something really amazing, that more than half of Americans, 53% of Americans, get into the top 10% of the income distribution for at least 1 year during their mm-hmm. lifetime. And then 70% of Americans get into the top 20% of the income distribution. And so that, you know, but then people don't usually stay there. So they might have right. one good year or several good years. So there really is a lot of fluidity and income mobility over time. And it's just harder to track individual households over time than it is to just report on median household income at a given point in time. So we have to, I think, understand and appreciate the fact that there is significant income mobility over time as people, you know, go from lower income categories to higher mm-hmm. income categories and then shift back down. So there's more income mobility than I think people understand or appreciate.
How does that, you know, one of the findings too, which sticks out in your data, is that, you know, if you're in a married household, two income household, and higher income households, not surprisingly, tend to have more earners in them. But essentially, if you're married for 20 years and you're both working, you're going to be doing extremely well.
Yeah, and I show a graph of real median family income for U.S. married couples with both spouses working. And those families are doing really well. I mean, the average mm-hmm. income for those, or median income for those, for that group is $111,000 last year. And that's mm-hmm. up from, you know, less than $35,000 back in 1949. So there's mm-hmm. been huge gains for married couples when they're both working. And then again, I also do in a separate report, you know, look at the, try to explain income inequality by demographics, and then am able to show that the higher income categories are generally, they have a greater average number of income earners than households in lower income quintiles. Mm-hmm. The individuals in high income households are more likely to be well educated, married, and working full time in their prime earning years. And then individuals in lower income households are far more likely to be less educated, working part-time, and either very young or very old, and living in single-parent or single household. So, again, that's another way to kind of understand why there are differences in income by looking at the household demographics
right.
that are kind of...
And I guess it means, you know, it's very different, too. If you're retired and you're, you know, 68 or 69, and you're making 12 grand a year, but you have income of 12 grand a year, but you have assets or other things that you're drawing down. That's a different situation than if you're a family of two or three in your 20s and you're making 12 grand. And it's worth, I guess statistics don't, you know, they don't always explain themselves or kind of draw the larger picture that would help them be more illustrative of, or informative when it comes to talking about stuff, much less setting policy.
Well, sure, and that's a good point, is that since we have more and more people living longer and who are in retirement, that could put some downward pressure on median household income, because if you're mm-hmm. only reporting your income that might be some pension amount or mm-hmm. some Social Security, you know, you might be in a lower income category as a retired person or couple, but then you might, in terms of assets, you might be in the top 20%. But so right. then again, there's that difference between income inequality and wealth inequality.
What is the, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the way that kind of the economic narratives get discussed. You know, both the right and the left, broadly speaking, whether they're politicians or media or commentators on this, they typically, you know, nobody wants to take credit for good times, because it seems like that leaves you, you know, with nothing to do from a policy perspective. People on the left will say, look, this you know, the current income distribution or the trends are bad. We need to do X, Y, and Z to, you know, transfer more money from the rich to the poor. Republicans will typically say, you know, this isn't good enough. What we need to do is to, you know, cut taxes and, you know, and actually now in the contemporary Republican Party, they're willing to say and subsidize certain types of businesses that are essential to, you know, American security or, you know, values or something like that. Where do we start to kind of come up with different stories to tell about policy? And I guess actually, let me just countermand what I just said. What are the policies that are, you know, that tend to help having a healthy, expanding economy like we seem to be having, or at least in terms of the way income is going?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. How nobody really wants to, or maybe they get more political payoff from painting a bleak negative narrative so that then it justifies some kind of public policy prescription to address whatever it is, income inequality or poor households. But, you know, I think, yeah, what we're seeing now is just kind of the result of going through a great recession, going through a 5-year or 6-year period of kind of subpar economic growth. Now we're finally getting back to maybe what would have been considered kind of a standard, normal, healthy, growing economy, which is creating, I think, you know, positive benefits for U.S. workers and U.S. companies. And so I guess, you know, part of it could just be the, you know, the long-term trends that we're getting back to kind of regression to the mean in terms of good, strong economic growth. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some positive benefits from Trump's kind of deregulating the economy and lowering taxes. So there could be some kind of momentum building up there. So I think part of it is it could be some positive changes from the Trump administration, along with changes that I think would have happened anyway, just because of the recovery finally kind of taking hold and moving forward in a way that might not have been really influenced significantly by public policy, but of course has been helped, I think, in some cases by Trump's anti-deregulation, pro-energy, lower taxes kind of positions.
But then does that also, and I guess this is more about fiscal and monetary policy, in the long run, to the extent that tax cuts release more money into the economy, but then they add to the debt. I mean, one of the issues that I've been covering and I find interesting is the idea of a debt overhang, and I guess this is the Rogoff and Reinhardt hypothesis that when you have massive levels of debt, you know, that approach, when you have a national debt that approaches the size of the annual economy, that it dampens economic growth for a number of years. Do you buy into that? And do you think that, you know, this is where, you know, are we pouring gasoline on a fire that is just going to then, you know, ultimately burn itself out very quickly?
Yeah, no, that's an important issue. Now, one important point is that In the reports about tax cuts, I think it seems like it's always assumed that cuts in tax rates lead to cuts in tax revenues, which isn't always the case. Mm-hmm. We've had experiences in the past where when we talk about tax cuts, it can be a cut in the rate, but an increase in tax revenue. So
Right. If
the cuts in the tax rates are, you know, stimulative enough, then we could actually have an increase in tax revenues that would address some of the problems with the deficit. So,
but then again, we also it seems like we have a, you know, tax cuts and then spending increases as well. So it always becomes very difficult to know what's going on or where it's going to end up.
Well, that's true as well. Yeah. I mean, cuts in tax rates, it could then have lead to an increase in tax revenues would be one thing. But then if they start spending more money, then that doesn't have is not going to lower the national debt. So, I mean, that is a big problem. That it's just not, I'm not quite sure how that's going to affect the long term, you know, economic growth in the country. But to the extent that we do see an increase in economic growth now over the next 5 or 10 years, you know, that could be one way that we could see a reduction in the national debt.
Do you have a sense that people are not taking, you know, they're not taking the good news seriously? And if so, why do you think that is?
You know, I think one way to that I've thought about it is that the benefits of a market economy and that constant march of progress are so constant and so gradual that either we don't appreciate it or don't notice it. And so we have an underappreciation of how much better things get all the time. And if it happened all at once, we'd probably just be amazed. But because all of these increases or improvements in consumer products, everything gradually gets better and better, that maybe people don't really have a understanding or appreciation because it happens so gradually, but so continually. But if you look back, if I look back to my days in high school or college and think of the differences today in terms of what a college student or a young American would have at their disposal in terms of the technology available and the internet and all of the products and GPS and the music that is now just, you know, flourishing on through Spotify, that it's maybe we just, and sometimes that's not even captured in, you know, economic statistics because so much of value we get now is for free. So maybe that's part of it, is that people don't even understand that they have $1,000 more today to spend per month on average per household than they did in 1975. And maybe some things are more expensive, but there's a lot of things that are much less expensive. Right. So if we just
and that are so much better. Yeah. I mean, I always, for one of my examples for that is always growing up, I guess in the 70s, you know, people would have parties when a car made it to 100,000 miles because it was so rare to see the odometer flip over. And now most new cars, you don't even think about changing the spark plugs until 100,000 miles. And that's, you know, kind of a, that's like a major shift in the quality and expectation of a very basic consumer good. And I guess now we're even getting to a point where people are starting to recognize cars are optional, which, you know, they used to be something everybody had to have for the most part.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an example of where the improvements in quality and durability have taken place over so long of a period of time and very gradually. I remember those days back when your car had 50,000 miles, the thinking was, boy, you better think about getting a new car, trading it in, because really bad stuff's going to start to happen once it hits 50,000.
And most of the floorboards were starting to go, and the fenders and everything were all starting to rust out as well. Or you couldn't put anything in the trunk because it would get wet from road spittle coming up. Where do we go with the disconnect between, or talk a little bit about the disconnect between some economic statistics that we use and maybe how they're missing what's going on? Because is it partly, you know, part of it might be that the stats that you're reporting on are all good, they're all pointing in the right direction, but then they're not capturing something more important. We hear this a lot with discussion of unemployment, and, you know, the idea that the way that the main unemployment figures that get reported don't really take into account people who are no longer even pretending to get a job or looking for a job, and that, you know, workforce participation rates, particularly among men in their prime earning years, are way down from where they were 15 or 20 years ago. And that's what we should be looking at rather than saying, oh, we've got unemployment at 4%. Look how everybody's working. Do we need new stats that might capture a truer but also possibly a darker reality?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. How do we collect statistics? How accurate are they? Do we need other statistics? I mean, in terms of what you're talking about, like the number of discouraged workers who are out of the labor force, I mean, we do track that every month. So, I mean, there are ways to see if, and that has been improving, the number of discouraged workers. Now, labor force participation rates, is, you know, some of that has changed just because of demographics and more people living longer and being in retirement. But then there's also, if you look at people in their prime years, like I think you're talking about, especially for men, then that has been going down. And maybe that is a concern that we need to look at, is why is it that men are less successful now than they used to be, not only in the workforce, but in higher education. When you look at now what 57% of college degrees are women, and they're dominating men at degree at all levels, from, you know, master's degrees to doctoral degrees, associate degrees, and bachelor degrees. So I don't know. I mean, that gets into an area of maybe sociology, and then I get out of my area of kind of expertise. No. So I don't know. But I think we do have good data, the labor market data, to be able to track trends over time. And then in terms of what we do about it, then that gets into more of the public policy.
Well, just to kind of wrap things up, or you know, do you want to make a prediction of this was all data that was based on 2017. Do you expect in a year, do you expect 2018's numbers to continue the track record of getting better while income inequality stays flat and things like that? Or, I mean, are you optimistic about the next couple of years, or, you know, we're what are we, 9 years into an expansion or something like that? It's, you know, a lot of people are starting to figure, you know, something's got to give sometime soon. And, you know, what's your sense of the next year or three?
Yeah, well, now that we're, what, in the fourth quarter of 2018, it looks pretty good right now in terms of wages, income, you know, so it seems like now, I don't think we're going to have any recession for maybe a few more years, but so if when the data come out next year for 2018, yeah, I would think just based on three quarters of the year so far looking pretty strong, that then I would predict that next year, if we had this conversation, we'd be talking about another increase in real household median income for Americans and a more positive trends in the economy even than we're looking at today.
Do you worry at all that, you know, you mentioned the Great Recession, financial crisis, whatever. Do you worry at all that we did not follow the right policy prescriptions? Because a lot of people talk about not only was that a huge, you know, it was a huge hit. A huge bubble had been blown up, and I suspect we would agree that that was largely done through government interventions into various aspects of the economy. But then it's taken, you know, it's a long, slow recovery. Did we learn the right lessons from it? And are we just kind of, you know, blindly walking into the future, but we're really not going to be able to deal with the next one with any more kind of acuity than we did this past one?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I know that maybe one trend that looks like we didn't really learn our lesson, and some of my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute, Ed Pinto and so on, they've been tracking, the mortgage finance industry, and it looks like we're maybe moving back in that direction of allowing people to buy houses with low down payments and with very poor credit histories. And so seems like now that since the government has so much influence over the mortgage finance market, that they now look like they're moving back in the wrong direction. So, I mean, maybe that, you know, could lead to problems in the future in the housing market. But of course, you know, it takes like, you know, it was the perfect storm last time where there was four or five different things that happened. So even if we had more problems in the housing market, as long as there wasn't other, you know, policies moving us in the wrong direction, it doesn't seem like that would lead to a recession. So hopefully the next recession, if I could predict, it won't happen for at least a couple more years, and it will be milder and shorter than the Great Recession.
Well, yeah, here's hoping. And a final question, what is, we touched, just skirted this for a second, but what is the, you know, what is the role of politics and of kind of federal policy? Like, you know, can you even hazard a guess to say, like, overall, you know, the economy is a pretty strong animal, and that, you know, people are going to do what they need to do to make money, or they're going to move ahead. But what percentage is government policy, you know, likely to screw up? Is it going to I'm trying to formulate this. I should have written it down. But is it, you know, can it shave, you know, 10 or 15% off economic activity? Can it increase it by that amount? Or, you know, how independent ultimately is the economy from whatever the, you know, the people in Washington are trying to do to it?
Yeah, great question. You know, and I think maybe what's most important is not so much policy, but policy uncertainty. And that really, like now with the trade war and so on, and you hear that a lot from industries, that they, what really disturbs them is the uncertainty about what's going to happen, because, you know, corporations are making long-term plans in terms of production and supply chain. So they're looking forward, and, you know, 5-10 years in the future. And so when they see that there's uncertainty about policy, that I think is what really then starts to distort decision making and capital spending, and they hold off on spending until they understand what the future is going to be. So
and clearly, that was a major. I mean, one would assume, I don't know how you quantify, but that was probably a major reason why the recovery was so slow, because you had, you know, at the same time everything is happening, you have Obamacare legislation not being, you know, is it even going to pass? Is it going to be vetted by the courts? And it's obviously going to have a major problem. But then there must have been 50 different things like that that injected massive amounts of uncertainty into the economy.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what's most damaging is the uncertainty about future policy or the effects of current mm-hmm. policies like Obamacare when it gets passed. How is that going to affect
right.
the economy 5 years out? So I think the business community likes certainty. And if they know what the rules are, they can adjust to the regulations, even if they don't like them. But that uncertainty about what's going to happen a year from now in terms of policy, that's what I think really distorts the economy in ways that are damaging.
So you mentioned, and in somewhat positive terms, some of, you know, Trump has definitely sounded a lot of deregulatory statements and has, you know, done certain types of things. When you talk to people who work with, the EPA or the FDA, the message is clear that this is going to be less, it's going to be a less harsh regulatory regime than in the past. But by the same token, Trump introduces uncertainty in almost every time he opens his mouth because you don't know what he's going to say. And now we have the midterms and we're, 2 years away from a presidential election. Do you think that level of uncertainty is going to freeze people, or is it more along the lines of like, we have no idea what our relationship with China is going to be, regardless of who wins in 2020, and that's that might freeze out certain types of economic activity.
Yeah, and it seems like the most, the highest level of uncertainty coming out of Team Trump mm-hmm. is in the area of trade. Maybe they're a little more consistent on taxes and energy and mm-hmm. regulation, but the trade part of it, that's where I think is the weakest part of the Trump administration, because I think they're wrongheaded on a lot of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And also that creates this uncertainty. Now, maybe some of that's getting resolved now with this new NAFTA 2.0. Mm-hmm. So maybe there'll be some, progress there where some of that uncertainty will be resolved. But I think that's the biggest danger going forward is the uncertainty about trade, because even in a world of zero tariffs, we would still have trade deficits with a lot of our trading partners. Mm-hmm. And then Trump would still be complaining about the trade deficit, because he really just doesn't understand international economics and international trade. So of any area going forward where there's going to be continued uncertainty, I'd see it in the area of trade policy.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. This has been The Reason Podcast. I have been your host, Nick Gillespie, and my guest today has been Mark J. Perry. He's an economist at the University of Michigan at Flint and at the American Enterprise Institute in D.C. He runs the great, just invaluable economics blog, Carpe Diem. And Mark, I want to thank you so much for talking about some good news and explaining why it may not all be going away very quickly. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason.com, and rate and review us while you're there.